Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Specialist in Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care, Helen Wilson. Thank you, Helen. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Ema. Welcome, everybody. We're going to talk about traumatic brain injury today and head trauma in general. So we'll just get right on with that and make a start. So when we're dealing with head trauma patients, we can actually split head trauma into traumatic brain injury and facial trauma, and we think of these things separately. Now, patients tend to present with one or the other of these conditions. Clearly, patients can present with both facial trauma and traumatic brain injury if they've had a very severe head injury. But generally, we tend to see patients with one or the other. Often, those patients with facial trauma are actually the most dramatic looking patients because they're the ones that have facial bone fractures, ocular trauma, those presenting with their jaws hanging off and their eyeballs hanging out, they tend to be the facial trauma patients. And the reason that we don't always see that in combination with traumatic brain injury is because if the bones of the face break, that acts as a compression zone to absorb some of the shock, and that actually tends to protect the brain a little bit. Those patients with presenting with traumatic brain injury, they're the ones that obviously have parenchymal damage to the brain itself, and they may or may not have skull fractures that is impacting on the brain. So for the presentation today, we're really going to focus on the traumatic brain injury patients more than the facial trauma patients. But when we're faced with any head trauma patient, before we get into dealing with what's going on in the head, we need to remember to always triage by our major body systems, of which obviously the brain is one, but also the heart and the lungs, because these are the organs through which failure will lead to death. And we need to remember to stabilize any other systemic life-threatening injuries before we focus only on the head trauma. And obviously patients presenting with head trauma can look very dramatic, particularly if they've got ocular damage or facial bone fractures, but it's important not to be distracted by those things at the expense of other systemic injuries. So we always need to assess our patients body-wide to assess for life-threatening conditions such as hypovolemia, pneumothorax, pulmonary contusions, any other issues with the airway or cardiovascular system that we need to focus on stabilising before we get into the stabilisation of the head injury. It's also important to consider with trauma patients whether or not there is a possibility of a back fracture. We may particularly suspect that in patients who have had a major impact trauma, such as a road traffic accident or a fall from a height, where they're not moving as we would expect them to, certainly if they're not moving their legs at all, or in fact if they're not moving in a way that we would expect, so they don't have normal mobility, then we may be concerned for a back fracture in those patients. And it's a good idea for those patients to stabilize them on a backboard, such as you can see in that picture there on the right hand side. We're using a whiteboard as a backboard, but you can use anything. Clipboards make very good backboards for cats or for small dogs, or any piece of wood essentially is a useful backboard. And what you want to do is place the patient on that, and if they'll tolerate it, just very gently strap them to it with some vet wrap and keep them on that backboard and immobilized until you've got some radiographs of the spine to rule in or out back and neck fractures. And then if there are no back fractures of concern, then of course the patient can be released from the backboard. And that's an important initial consideration, because obviously we don't want to risk moving a spine and worsening any spinal cord injury if there is a back fracture present. For those patients who are presenting with facial trauma, then analgesia is, of course, paramount, and we always want to start with full agonist opioids. It's always frustrating with these cases if you start with a partial agonist, such as buprenorphine, and then that's not enough analgesia. It can be difficult then to top them up to get good control of their pain status. Whereas if you start with a full agonist opioid, such as methadone, morphine, fentanyl, then if they turn out to not require such a high level of analgesia down the line, it's easy to downgrade them, but it can be difficult to, or more challenging to go in the opposite direction to upgrade their analgesia. As we mentioned before, we want to treat any systemic issues. So these patients may have lost a lot of blood and therefore be hypovolemic, and then we want to be focusing on that with a fluid bolus. If they have trauma to the eyes, one or both eyeballs, then it's important to lubricate the eyes to prevent desiccation whilst we're assessing further what we need to do with those. And of course, patients with head trauma, they can have airway obstruction with blood or other secretions, and if that's the case, then we may need to suction their airway to clear it in the first instance. Now, traumatic brain injury, to focus on the traumatic brain injury side of things now a little bit, we can split traumatic brain injury into the primary brain injury and the secondary brain injury. And the primary brain injury is what happens to the brain at the time of the trauma. So this is at the point of impact or whatever other trauma occurs to the brain. That is the injury that the brain sustains at that moment in time. So the primary brain injury is something that has happened by the time we see the patient, and there's nothing that we can do about that. And instead, our efforts are focused on minimizing what we call the secondary brain injury. And the secondary brain injury is a chain reaction of biochemical processes that occurs within the brain, which ultimately, if left unchecked, leads to cellular death. And so our efforts are focused on minimizing the degree of apoptosis that occurs within the brain after the primary brain injury has occurred. So this secondary brain injury can develop over hours to days after the initial trauma, and that's what our job is as vets, is to minimize the extent of that secondary brain injury. So in terms of the primary brain injury, there are a number of different injuries which we can define with the brain. The least severe is a concussion, and a concussion is generally defined as a brief loss of consciousness. Following on from that, we can have a contusion. Here's a schematic of a contusion. A contusion is where we get some degree of parenchymal hemorrhage with associated edema, and that may also go hand in hand with a loss of consciousness that can persist for several minutes. Then we can have axial hematomas. Obviously, we know what a hematoma is, and an axial hematoma is one that develops within the parenchyma of the brain or the spinal cord, so within the substance of the central nervous system itself. Extra-axial hematomas, they occur outside the brain, so they occur within the subarachnoid, the subdural and the epidural spaces, and they're then putting pressure onto the brain from externally. In people, about 10% of mild head injuries will have an extra-axial hematoma associated with them, through to about 80% of patients who have severe head injuries. So we don't have those statistics for our veterinary patients, but in people, they're the sort of incidence of injuries that we see associated with extra-axial hematomas. And then the most severe type of primary brain injury is a laceration. And a laceration is where you actually have a tear within the parenchyma of the brain. And that is the most severe injury because that is the most difficult to recover from because you've got actual tearing or slicing through of axons and nerves, and that is associated with the most severe injury, the worst prognosis for recovery. So that's the primary traumatic brain injury. And then in terms of the secondary brain injury that we were speaking about before, we can subdivide that into systemic factors and intracranial factors in terms of things that are potentiating the degree of secondary brain injury. So if we think about what can go on systemically for the patient, well, hypotension is important. We need good blood supply to the brain, as we'll talk more about in a bit, to deliver oxygen and nutrients to the brain. Hypoxia, similarly, the brain needs a good oxygen supply in order to normally respire and normally function. Both low and high CO2 is bad for the brain because it has effects on vasoconstriction and vasodilation. So if your CO2 is high, it stimulates vasodilation, which can result in increased intracranial pressure. And if your CO2 is low, that stimulates vasoconstriction, which can then limit oxygen delivery to the brain. So both of those are bad for a recovering brain, and it's important that the CO2 is maintained within a normal range. Hypo and hyperglycemia is also associated with the degree of brain injury, and again, electrolyte disturbances, acid-base disturbances, these will all affect the function of the brain during the post-injury phase. Thinking about intracranial factors, things happening within the skull that will affect the function of the brain following an injury. Overall, the pressure within the calvarium, the intracranial pressure, is clearly very important, and we're going to talk more about that later. We want to limit any increase in the pressure within the skull because that will affect the function of the brain. Space-occupying lesions, so things like hematomas, are going to affect the function of the brain, and similarly, if we have depressed skull fractures, something pushing down onto the parenchyma of the brain, that's also going to affect its functionality. And edema associated with contusions or with depressed skull fractures, again, that's going to affect our brain functionality. If we've got damage to the blood-brain barrier, then we may have leakage of either whole blood or just edema development within the parenchyma. And if we've got vasospasm, as we mentioned before, with changes in CO2, if we've got vasospasm for other reasons, such as a result of the impact itself, then that's going to limit our arterial blood supply to the brain and limit our delivery of oxygen and glucose. So these are all things which can potentiate secondary injury to the brain, potentiate damage following a head trauma. And how does that happen to the brain? How does the brain actually become injured by these secondary measures? Well, there's a number of different mechanisms which can lead to this secondary brain injury. One is the concept of excitotoxicity. You may be familiar with this from talks associated with status epilepticus. And excitotoxicity is a phenomenon where you get massive release of excitatory neurotransmitters. That can occur in reaction to a trauma. So a blunt impact can cause massive release of excitatory neurotransmitters. They cause depolarization of the cells, and that sets up a vicious circle which leads to more release of excitatory neurotransmitters, more depolarization, and so on and so forth. And what happens with that vicious circle is that the cells become deplete of energy because they're being constantly stimulated more than they're able to keep up with. And ultimately, if you get ATP depletion from overstimulated cells, then that leads to apoptosis through calcium influx. An influx of calcium into cells is the signal for apoptosis. And once these cells die, that's a non-recoverable injury. So we want to limit the degree of cell death which occurs within the brain. And another mechanism by which the secondary injury to the brain occurs is through free radical or reactive oxygen species production. So what is a free radical? Well, a free radical is an atom that has an unpaired electron, as you can see from that picture at the bottom there. So an unpaired electron is an unstable state for an atom to be in. And what those atoms do is they go and steal an electron from another atom that does have a pair of electrons. And then in so doing, it creates another free radical. So the one that it's stolen an electron from becomes a free radical. And that's a chain reaction. So each atom that becomes damaged then goes and steals an electron from another atom. The brain is particularly susceptible to this type of injury because the brain is full of lipid membranes, and a lipid is a very good medium for transferring electrons. So it's easy for atoms within lipid membranes to donate electrons. And so what happens with free radical damage in the brain is you get this sort of wildfire effect where these free radicals zip along the lipid membrane, stealing electrons as they go and just tear swathes of holes in these cells, making them damaged, making them leaky, leading to apoptosis. Free radical production is favored by ischemic environments. It actually becomes worse when blood flow is then restored. So when blood flow is limited, you get a burst of free radicals produced, but then when you restore blood flow, you get an even bigger burst of free radical production. So that's the ischemia reperfusion injury. And production of free radicals is also really favored by situations where hemorrhage is around, because some of the most reactive radicals, particularly the hydroxyl radical, is produced by iron-rich environments. So if you've got bleeding and you've got ischemia, these things will produce a large number of free radicals, which are then going to wreak havoc upon the brain. So this is something else that we want to try to limit during our treatment of traumatic brain injury patients. And then also, inflammatory mediators will potentiate secondary brain injury. So what do they do? Well, they cause local vasodilation. That causes an influx of inflammatory cells. That disrupts the blood-brain barrier and alters your normal hemostasis. So then you can get worsened bleeding into parts of the brain around those damaged vessels. And you get inflammatory mediator release after any significant blunt impact. So whenever you get a trauma, that's associated with a large inflammatory stimulus. So that's sort of an overview of what happens during traumatic brain injury. And now we're going to move on to talk about how we actually assess these patients when we're presented with them and what we can do to stabilize them and to limit the extent of damage to their brain. Okay, so when we're presented with a patient, firstly, we want to assess the level of mentation. We recognize four different levels of mentation. The first one is normal, bright, alert, and responsive. So this little doggy here, bright, alert, responsive, normal mentation. The next level down is obtunded. And obtunded is a bit of an umbrella term, a catch-all term, and it's a spectrum. Patients can be quite mildly obtunded through to very severely obtunded. And really what that means is that they have a reduced responsiveness to stimuli. So they will still react to being spoken to being touched. You can shine a light in their eye and they'll react to that, they'll look round. All these things will produce a response, but they won't react in quite such a vigorous way as a normal bright, alert and responsive patient would. So they have a reduced responsiveness to stimuli. Patients may be obtunded because of a primary brain injury, but they are often obtunded because of systemic disease. So hypoperfusion, low blood pressure, acid-base disturbances, all of these things will contribute to a degree of obtundation. And when people use the terms depressed and dull, really that what they mean is obtunded. Depressed and dull are human emotional terms, and so we shouldn't really apply them to our patients. We don't really know whether they're feeling depressed or not. But really, that's what we mean by those terms. We mean that they're obtunded and they have a reduced responsiveness to stimuli. The next level down is stupor, and stuporous patients are responsive only to painful stimuli. So for patients who are in a stupor, you can talk to them, you can shine a light in their eye, you can stroke them pretty vigorously, and they won't react to any of those things. You know, you could bang a saucepan next to their ears if you wanted to, and they're not going to react to anything. But if you squeeze their toe, they will turn around and look at you. So they can react to painful stimuli, but nothing else. And then the worst level of mentation is coma, and that's where patients are not responsive to any stimuli at all, including painful stimuli. So certainly for stuporous or comatose patients, we would generally be more concerned that that is indeed associated with an injury to the brain itself. If you're presented with a stuporous or comatose patient, do remember to check blood glucose because hypoglycemic patients can present stuporous or comatose as well. So you just want to double check that their glucose is normal before concluding that you're dealing with a brain injury that's producing that mentation change. So as we've just said, obtundation can be due to changes in the neurologic system, but may also be due to systemic illnesses or systemic conditions. So remember to do your full body systems assessment to check for other life-threatening injuries, because often what we find with obtunded patients is if they are obtunded because they're hypoperfused, then if you give them a fluid bolus, their mentation massively improves after systemic stabilization. So remember not to assume that it's the brain that's causing a change in mentation. How else can we assess head trauma patients? Well, aside from what their mentation is doing, then we can also use the modified Glasgow Coma score. And this gives a numeric score between 3 and 18 to give us a more objective measure of where our patients are. So higher scores are associated with a better prognosis, lower scores with a worse prognosis. And the way this scale works is that we assess three different categories for the patients, and each one gets a score of between 1 and 6, and then you add up each of those three categories to give you an overall score. So we're scoring these patients on their level of consciousness, their motor activity, and their brainstem reflexes. And certainly, if we have a patient that's presenting truly in a coma, then that is associated with global cerebral abnormalities, and that is associated with a worse prognosis. So here is a copy of a Glasgow Coma score form. Apologies that it's a little bit small. This is just for you to have an idea of what it looks like. So you can see that there are three major categories that I've highlighted there, and then subcategories of each. So you score the patient according to where they fit into each of those three categories and add up their score overall. So there was a paper from 2001 which looked at the use of the Glasgow Coma Score for assessing patient survival, and what they found was that the outcome at 48 hours with a modified Glasgow Coma Score of 8 was 50%. So that's not a prognostic indicator, that's just an outcome indicator, and what we can find is that the presenting Glasgow Coma Score often doesn't reflect how patients will be after you've done some aggressive systemic stabilisation with them, because as we've already said, systemic factors can affect their mentation and their coma scale score. And so it's important to reassess their Glasgow Coma Score after we've done some aggressive stabilisation with them to see where they're at. What the Glasgow Coma Score is useful for is for monitoring patients over time. So I don't use a single point score to prognosticate, but it is useful to track what their Glasgow Coma Score is doing. And certainly, if it's getting worse despite very aggressive treatment, that is not a good sign that your patient is doing well. You know, things are going in the wrong direction. So it's useful to give you an objective measure for signs of deterioration. And as you can see from this table up here, scores of 15 to 18, that's associated with a good prognosis. 9 to 14 is a guarded prognosis, and certainly 3 to 8 is a grave prognosis. So it's useful to bear that in mind, but as I say, don't use an initial presenting number, a single score to prognosticate to owners, because that may be misleading. We can also look at the patient's posture to give us some idea of what may be going on. There are two sort of major neurologic postures that we identify with patients. One is a decerebellate rigidity posture, and the other is decerebrate rigidity. So with decerebellate rigidity, this is the cat at the top. This cat has decerebellate rigidity, and these patients have opisthotonus, so they have their forelimbs are rigidly extended and their neck tends to be arched backwards, and the pelvic limbs can be variably either flexed or extended, but the hallmark of this particular posture is that they have a normal mentation. So as you can see from that cat there, it's able to look at me, it knows what's going on, but its forelimbs are rigidly extended, and although you can't appreciate that from a still image, but when the cat was not looking at the camera, its head was arched back, much like the cat in the bottom picture. So the posture can appear similar, but the hallmark is that with decerebellate rigidity, the patient is able to look at you and is aware. And these postures are associated with acute lesions of the cerebellum, as the name would suggest. Decerebrate rigidity is where we've got a lesion of the midbrain, the rostral brainstem, and the forebrain, and that results in opisthotonus, as this cat is demonstrating down the bottom, so where you've got rigid extension of the thoracic limbs and the head is arched backwards. In this posture, they do have rigid extension of all four limbs, so the pelvic limbs are not flexed like they can be with decerebellate rigidity, and the mentation is always abnormal in this posture, so they have either a stuporous or a comatose level of mentation. So that can help to give an indication of whereabouts in the brain the problem is. And we can look at the pupils themselves as well to give us an idea of what's going on in terms of how severe the injury to the brain is, as well as whereabouts the problem may be. So we may identify that the pupils are the same size as each other. They may be different sizes from each other, so we may have a nicer choria. They may be too small, they may be too big. And in addition to pupillary size changes, we want to assess for their responsiveness to light, and it's important to remember to shine a light not only into the one eye, but also to when you're shining a light into that eye and assessing for the direct pupillary light reflex, to look in the opposite eye as well for signs of a consensual reflex. So when you shine a light into one eye, that pupil obviously should constrict, but the opposite pupil should also constrict. It will never constrict as much as the one that you're shining the light into, but it should nonetheless constrict. If it doesn't constrict at all, or if in fact it dilates, then that is abnormal. That's an abnormal PLR. Remember to interpret that in light of what other things are going on with the patient, particularly in terms of is there trauma to the eyes themselves? Because clearly, if you've stretched the optic nerve, that may affect your pupillary light reflex. And also, whether the patient has received any drugs, and once they've got opioids or other drugs on board, then that may affect your ongoing interpretation of the PLRs. Now, of course, we would never withhold analgesia from a patient, but it's just something to bear in mind that once they've got analgesic drugs on board, that will potentially affect our interpretation of the pupillary light reflexes. So that cat in the picture there, that's my own cat after she'd had midazolam and ketamine to give blood, even though she's doing a beautiful example there of a bilateral mydriasis. So if we have a bilateral meiosis, then that tends to indicate a diffuse injury of the forebrain, so that's the higher centres. If we've got a bilateral mydriasis, then that suggests that we've got lesions of the oculomotor nerve, so cranial nerve 3 may be the actual nucleus of that nerve that's affected. And we can certainly see that when we're experiencing herniation of the brain, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And so assessment of pupils is useful when we're dealing with head trauma patients because there's a bit of a sliding scale of severity of brain injury and prognosis based on what the pupils are doing. So this diagram that I've got here shows going from the top from being the best prognosis through to the worst prognosis at the bottom. So if you're presented with essentially normal pupils, so mid-range pupils with normal pupillary light reflex, then that's associated with a good prognosis. If you've got variation in the size of the two pupils, so a nicer choria, but they're still reactive to light, that's a good to slightly more guarded prognosis. If you've got a nicer chorea but they're not reacting to light, that is a more guarded prognosis. And then from there, we go to a bilateral meiosis, which is associated with a worse prognosis still. If the pupils are kind of normal size, mid-range, but they're not reacting to light, that's a poor prognosis. And if you've got blown pupils, so bilateral mydriasis, that it's not reactive to light, then that is associated with the worst prognosis. Remember that we always assess these pupils in combination with mentation as well. So if you had a bilateral mydriasis in a patient that had perfectly normal mentation, of course we need to rule out other ocular things such as iris atrophy that might be giving a false impression of a bilateral unresponsive mydriasis. So that's just a simplified version of the previous slide. So essentially, the sliding scale is normal pupils, then a nicer choria, then meiosis, then mydriasis, having the worst prognosis. And in terms of our stabilization of these patients, well, initially, we're going to give them oxygen. Of course, we give all emergencies oxygen straight away. The only contraindication to oxygen is if your patient is on fire, so it's never going to do any harm to give the patient oxygen. It's useful in traumatic brain injury because if you've got any degree of vasospasm, it's going to limit your oxygen delivery. And so we do want to make sure that the brain is well oxygenated so that it can perform its normal metabolic functions. But it is important that we don't cause the patient any degree of stress by delivering the oxygen, because if they become stressed and they struggle to try and get away from it, that will actually raise the intracranial pressure, which is more counterproductive than productive. So you'll notice in this picture here, I'm giving that dog flow-by oxygen, and I prefer that to a face mask. I mean, if you've got a really completely non-responsive patient, they may well tolerate a face mask. But generally, patients don't really like having something put over their face. They'll struggle to try and get away from it. And that activity of struggling can be enough to raise their intracranial pressure, as well as raising their general metabolic demand, which is never good for an emergency patient who may be hypovolemic, may have acid base disturbances. Any degree of struggling or stress is going to contribute and worsen that. So flow by oxygen is better than face mask oxygen for most of these patients. And we've already mentioned analgesia, and as I said before, we want to use full agonist opioids for these patients. Non-steroidals are not appropriate in an emergency situation until we're confident that the patient is cardiovascularly stable, normal blood pressure, normal perfusion, of course, before we start non-steroidal drugs. So we want to focus initially on our extracranial stabilization, and once we're happy with that, we can think about the intracranial stabilization a little bit more. So in terms of extracranial stabilization, we want to make sure that the patient is normovolemic. So clearly, if we're presented with a trauma patient, they may be hypovolemic if they have some blood loss. If they have concurrent traumatic brain injury, then actually this is a situation where normal saline is a fluid of choice over and above Hartmann's. It doesn't really matter that much at the end of the day which fluid you choose, but sodium chloride, 9.9% sodium chloride, does have a little bit less free water in it than other isotonic crystalloids, and in this instance that can be useful because it will minimize any contribution to cerebral edema. So if you've got some cerebral edema already, by giving a fluid that's got less free water in than others, you may limit the degree to which that cerebral edema develops. And we worry a lot about raised intracranial pressure following traumatic brain injury, and the reason that we worry so much about that is because that's probably the most common thing that causes death for these patients. So things that will raise the intracranial pressure, well, hemorrhage, inflammation, cerebral edema, anything that causes an increase in the total volume within the skull will raise the pressure within the skull, and that can result in herniation of the brain and is immediately life-threatening. So we need to be very alert to the possibility of raised intracranial pressure for these patients and treating it at the earliest opportunity if we identify that. And we talk about this thing called the Monroe-Kelly doctrine, and I quite like this because it's quite a good visual for what's actually going on. So the Monroe-Kelly doctrine describes the skull, the calvarium, as a solid box. So here it is. This is a solid box of the skull, and that contains three incompressible substances. Those three substances are the CSF, there it is, the brain, and the blood. So these are the three substances that reside within the skull, each of which is incompressible in its own right. And so we can think about the space that is within the skull as being a finite space. And if the volume of any one of those three things increases, then the volume of one of the other three has, sorry, one of the remaining two has to decrease in order to maintain the total available space that's within the skull. So for those of you that are struggling with this visual, there are the ears. So we would be looking at this dog face on from the nose to see what's going on inside the skull there. So if we get an excessive increase in volume within the calvarium, then what's going to happen? Well, it's going to result in herniation of the brain, which basically means that the brain gets extruded through the foramen magnum and down the neck because there's no available room in the skull for any further expansion. So there's a very limited amount of swelling that the brain is able to do safely, or well, it's never safe, but you know, there's a limited amount of swelling that the brain can do. So I apologize for this hand-drawn picture. I drew this when I was revising for my board exams and couldn't find a decent schematic of this anywhere. But this just basically indicates that there are different ways in which the brain is able to herniate within the skull. But the most common way that the brain herniates, and the easiest one to think about visually, is that it moves backwards through the foramen magnum and goes down, travels down the neck, down the spinal cord. That's called tonsillar herniation, and you can see that on the right hand side of the picture there. So I've got quite a visual mind, and I tend to think of this like a tube of toothpaste. So the brain gets extruded like toothpaste through the foramen magnum and down the neck. When we're dealing with traumatic brain injury patients, we need to consider the perfusion pressure to the brain. So the cerebral perfusion pressure is the pressure with which the arterial blood is supplied to the brain. And that is basically defined by the mean arterial pressure, so the pressure of the blood going to the brain, minus the intracranial pressure, so minus the pressure that's within the skull, and that's effectively the resistance to flow of blood into the brain. The brain is reasonably good at auto-regulating its blood flow, but after a trauma, it tends to lose that auto-regulatory capacity. And if that happens, then the brain can't necessarily maintain good perfusion pressure, and therefore it's more likely to suffer ischemic injury. So actually, after a trauma has occurred, the brain is even more likely to go on to get ischemic injury. And so to counteract that, when we're dealing with our emergency patients, or our emergency traumatic brain injury patients, we want to always aim to maintain our systolic blood pressure above 100. So if our systolic blood pressure is above 100, then that is generally considered to be a sufficient degree of blood pressure to maintain adequate cerebral perfusion for brain injury patients. Okay, so we were talking about the raised intracranial pressure, and if the pressure in the brain goes up, as we said on the slide before, that's going to limit your perfusion pressure, so that's not good. And as we said on the slide before that, it's also going to contribute to herniation of the brain, which is also not good. So how do we actually look out for raised intracranial pressure? Well, unfortunately, our ways of monitoring the pressure within the brain are relatively crude, and we're pretty much limited to looking out for this thing called the Cushing's reflex, which is really quite a late stage change for what's going on in the brain. And what that is, it's a systemic response to raised intracranial pressure. So if the pressure within the brain or within the calvarium is increasing, then that will reach a point where it causes a sympathetic nervous system discharge. And when the sympathetic nervous system discharges, what happens? Well, that causes vasoconstriction. And the reason that that's happening is that as the pressure in the brain goes up, the brain is recognizing that it's not getting enough blood flow to it. And so you get this sympathetic nervous system discharge to cause peripheral vasoconstriction to try to force blood back towards the brain to maintain perfusion. So that raises your mean arterial pressure. And in reaction to that, the baroreceptors in the carotid bodies recognize a sudden spike in blood pressure, and they think, oh, that shouldn't be happening, shouldn't have a big spike in blood pressure. Oh, that's not right. And it triggers a reflex bradycardia to try to limit that increase in blood pressure. So a Cushing's reflex is characterized by hypertension with a reflex bradycardia. And we don't see a Cushing's reflex in patients that have normal mentation because, as I said, this happens as a late stage change to raised intracranial pressure. And so these patients are always going to have an abnormal level of mentation. And we may actually see quite a rapid deterioration in their mentation as they go on to develop their Cushing's reflex if things are changing quickly. So that is concerning because it always indicates a life-threatening rise in intracranial pressure. Because it's such a late stage change when we see that, it means that the brain is on the point of herniation when the Cushing's reflex occurs. So if we identify a Cushing's reflex in a patient, we need to start immediate treatment for that. And our treatment options are either mannitol or hypertonic saline to try to reduce the intracranial pressure. So we never treat patients for raised intracranial pressure if they have normal mentation. We do that if the mentation is abnormal, and we've got indication as well of a Cushing's reflex. So if we're choosing to use mannitol, then the dose is between half and 1.5 grams per kilo over 20 minutes. And mannitol is an osmotic diuretic, and it works as an osmotic agent to draw excessive water out of the brain. So it limits brain swelling by virtue of being a large molecule that is trapped within the blood vessels. And so it has an osmotic action to suck fluid back into the circulatory system and away from the brain, and therefore reduces the intracranial pressure. It does also have a direct rheologic effect on the brain as well, so it can help to improve perfusion through the small capillaries of the brain. So because it also acts as an osmotic diuretic within the kidneys, then it's important to continue isotonic crystalloids after you've given mannitol to these patients to make sure that they remain well perfused, and just keep an eye that they don't become hypovolemic following a mannitol bolus, because they can suddenly lose a large volume of fluid through their kidneys. So we just need to stay on top of their perfusion status after delivery of mannitol. So when we give mannitol, those of you who are familiar with mannitol will probably know this, but it tends to crystallize out in solution, so it needs to be warmed before giving it to make sure all the crystals are dissolved. But even so, we don't want to deliver any microscopic crystals IV, and so we always give mannitol through a filter. And I know that this is a rather small picture, but you can just about see there's a little green filter down there at the bottom of that IV bandage, that red IV bandage, and that's the filter through which we always administer mannitol. Alternatively, then we can give hypertonic saline, and rather than a dose range, we just give a set dose of hypertonic saline, which is 4 mils per kilo, and we give that, aim to give that over about 15 minutes. It's certainly important that we don't give it any faster than 5 minutes, because that is associated with osmotic demyelination, which can be associated with, well, they can recover from it, but it's often associated with a non-survivable injury to the brain. It generally presents about 5 days after the hypertonic saline has been given. So overall, it acts pretty similarly to mannitol. It acts by increasing the tonicity within the blood and therefore drawing any fluid out of the brain to reduce brain swelling. And again, it also has rheologic effects to improve perfusion to the small capillaries. I quite like this, particularly if there is concurrent hypovolemia, because it can serve to volume resuscitate the patient as well as treating raised intracranial pressure. So you can kill two birds with one stone with that, which I find that quite nice when you're stabilizing a trauma patient to be able to do two jobs at once. There is some evidence from some meta-analyses from people that hypertonic saline may have some benefits over mannitol, but essentially that's still up for debate and discussion. So ongoing discussion as to which is better, and really you can use either, but I personally do prefer hypertonic saline to mannitol. So as we've already said, the Cushing's reflex is a very late stage change that we see in the brain. And so if you suspect that you do have raised intracranial pressure based on severe mentation changes in the face of traumatic brain injury, and that that's persisting despite your systemic stabilization, then even in the absence of a Cushing's reflex, you may wish to treat with hypertonic saline or mannitol as a trial to see whether the patient's mentation improves or not. The response to both of these drugs is immediate, so as soon as the hypertonic saline or the mannitol are in, you should see an immediate improvement in mentation. If they're not improving straight away, then that suggests that they're not responding to it. So that may be that you don't have a raised intracranial pressure, or that they're just not responding to the treatment. I often get asked whether we can use any other drugs for raised intracranial pressure. The short answer to that is no. I commonly get asked whether we should give steroids to traumatic brain injury patients, and we know that that is actually contraindicated and is associated with worse outcomes at both 2 weeks and 6 months, because if we give a dose of steroids, that will suppress the immune system and can be associated with significant infection down the line. The reason that this can be given to people is because there's some evidence that the use of steroids in traumatic brain injury in people improves the ability to move their little finger at 6 months. That's important for people because moving your little finger can be the difference between being able to communicate versus not able to communicate. But clearly for dogs and cats, that's an irrelevant outcome. If their only functionality were to move their little toe, that's not a functional dog or a cat. So overwhelmingly, steroids are not useful for our patients and are contraindicated rather than having any utility. And similarly, I quite often get asked whether we can give furosemide to patients with raised intracranial pressure. And again, that's not a good idea unless there is another indication for it. So if the patient is presenting in concurrent congestive heart failure, then yes, of course, they need furosemide. But if it's just purely for traumatic brain injury, then that won't help with the with any degree of cerebral swelling. But what it may well do is potentiate hypovolemia and therefore hypotension through its diuretic effect. And that may, as a knock-on effect, worsen the cerebral perfusion pressure by lowering blood pressure, and therefore that may actually contribute to worsening brain injury through a reduction in perfusion and therefore a reduction in oxygen and glucose delivery to the brain. Other drugs that we can consider in traumatic brain injury, we might want to think about free radical scavengers. So as I mentioned earlier on, one of the mechanisms of the secondary brain injury is free radical production, and that's quite significant in the brain. And so N-acetylcysteine can be very useful for as a free radical scavenger. I do like this, and I give this to traumatic brain injury patients as standard, because it's got very minimal side effects associated with it. So it's a pretty benign drug to give, and we're unlikely to do any harm. Unfortunately, the benefits remain quite theoretical. It seems to make sense to me that giving a free radical scavenger will help in a situation where we know that free radicals are part of the pathology of the worsening brain injury. But unfortunately, as yet, any outcome benefits remain unproven with N-acetylcysteine. So there was a study in people that didn't show any outcome benefit for those receiving it versus not. So it may be that it's not helpful, but I think we just don't really know whether it is or it isn't helpful, and it's certainly something that we can continue to consider for these patients. Because it's benign, personally, I will probably continue to give that. But as I say, the benefit for its use remains unproven. Other things that we can do, so aside from drugs, there are other things that we can do to help our brain injury patients. One of the most important things is to have the head elevated between 15 and 30 degrees. And when we talk about elevating the head, we don't mean elevating only the head, because if you just prop the head up, that will actually bend the neck, and that can occlude the jugular veins and therefore actually reduce venous drainage from the brain, and that can increase the intracranial pressure. So what we want to do is actually have the entire patient on a slant. So you can see from that photo there, the whole dog is on a wedge with the head uppermost. If it's a smaller patient, such as a cat, then I think putting the cat on a clipboard with some towels underneath it to prop the clipboard up works quite well. But the idea is that if you've got the head elevated to between 15 and 30 degrees, then that increases venous drainage from the brain and therefore reduces the intracranial pressure. But if you were to elevate the head beyond 30 degrees, that would actually impact on your cerebral perfusion pressure, because the heart's then having to pump harder to pump the arterial blood uphill to the brain, and therefore that would reduce your oxygen delivery. So that's why the ideal angle is between 15 and 30 degrees. For the same reason of avoiding raising intracranial pressure, it's important not to do jugular sticks on these patients, because again, when we occlude the jugular to raise it to take a blood sample, that is impeding drainage from the brain, and even a brief period of occlusion like that can have an impact on your intracranial pressure. So it's much better to avoid jugular sticks on these patients and to take blood samples from peripheral veins instead. And when we're monitoring these patients following traumatic brain injury, then we want to do regular mentation checks, and the frequency of that is going to vary depending on the severity of injury to your patient. So if you've got a badly injured patient, then you might be wanting to do that every 30 to 60 minutes when they first present, particularly to look for signs of deterioration in the face of aggressive treatment, because that's never a good sign, but also to monitor your treatment efficacy. So if you're your patient is deteriorating despite your treatment, then you need to re-evaluate your treatment plan and see if there's anything that you're not doing that you could do to try to improve the situation. And as we said before, we want to be maintaining our systolic blood pressure above 100 to make sure that we've got good cerebral perfusion pressure and that we're delivering a good amount of oxygen to these injured brains. We mentioned before that it's important to maintain carbon dioxide within the normal range. So this is not always so easy to monitor, because we don't always have these patients intubated. You can monitor end-tidal CO2 by having intranasal catheters in place, but I avoid that in traumatic brain injury, because if you've got anything inside the nose, that can cause irritation to the nose and can raise the intracranial pressure. So that's actually contraindicated. But if we do have a patient that is intubated, then we want to have a capnograph on them and be maintaining their CO2 in the normal range to prevent either excessive cerebral vasodilation or vasoconstriction, which will contribute to raised intracranial pressure and cerebral ischemia, respectively. And of course, we want to maintain good oxygen flow to the brain as well. So if we are monitoring SpO2, certainly we want it to remain above 94% at all times. If we're not monitoring them by pulse ox, then just giving flow by oxygen as a default is a good idea for these patients to make sure that we are supplementing the brain as much as possible, maintaining a good level of oxygenation. Hyperglycemia is associated with the degree of injury in head trauma, but it's important to be aware that it's not associated with outcomes. So it's not prognostic if we have a hyperglycemic patient, but it is nonetheless indicative of the severity of injury because it's a sympathoadrenal response, cortisol being an insulin antagonist. So the more cortisol we have released following injury, then the higher our blood glucose is going to be. So we shouldn't be attempting glycemic control, or certainly we don't have evidence for that yet in veterinary medicine. That's something that sort of gets talked about a bit in people, but the risk of using insulin to control glucose is greater than just not doing it, because a significant amount of those patients will have a hypoglycemic episode as a result of having being given insulin to try to control their glucose. And if they're hypoglycemic, that's worse for the brain overall. So hyperglycemia is something that I sort of look at in these patients and make a mental note of it in terms of assessing the severity of the injury, but it's not something that I use as a prognostic indicator. And the nursing care is obviously very important for these patients. They often have abnormal mentation and they're not having normal mobility. So we need to think about all these sorts of nursing considerations, urinary care, do they need a UCATH in if they're just going to be urinating on the bed and getting urine scald, and similarly checking that the bed is dry all the time. If they're not mobile, we want to be turning them every 4 hours to prevent decubital ulcers. We want to be doing passive range of motion on all of their legs every 4 hours as well, so that they don't start to get stiff joints. We want to be regularly lubricating the eyes every 4 hours or so as well, and also cleaning the mouth with something like a chlorhexidine mouthwash, because if they're not swallowing normally, then they can start to get an overgrowth of bacteria in the mouth that can actually track down the trachea and set up a secondary pneumonia. So we want to maintain good oral hygiene as well. If these patients are missing a gag reflex, it's really important that we do intubate them. They don't necessarily need to be connected to a circuit. They may be fine just breathing room air or having flow by oxygen by the end of the ET tube, which is what's happening in this photo here. But certainly if they have no gag reflex, it's very important that we protect their airway, because otherwise they're at significant risk of aspiration pneumonia. If possible, it's better to use a sterile ET tube, because it's likely that that's going to be in for some time. And certainly if they have a tube in for a period of time, we should be changing that tube at least once every 24 hours, and we should be changing the position of the cuff every 8 hours to make sure that the airway remains well protected and sterile. When we have a head trauma patient, it can be really difficult to know how to image these guys, and certainly radiographs are just not very helpful for imaging, because the skull is obviously a 3D box, and taking a radiograph of the skull, it's very easy to miss fractures. You just can't really assess very well what's going on. So generally, the imaging modality of choice for these guys is a CT, and of course not everybody has a CT available to them, but it's especially useful to consider a CT if we have a patient who is having an acute deterioration despite treatment, or they've started to improve and then they suddenly get worse, or they're just not improving after the first couple of days or so of treatment, and we would expect to see some signs of improvement by then. And if they're not getting better, then that's an indication for some more advanced imaging to try to work out what's going on and why are they not getting better. MRI is more useful than CT for looking at the detailed parenchyma of the brain, but it's often not ideal in an emergency situation because it takes a lot longer to acquire an MRI. The patient has to be physically in the scanner for a significant period of time compared with a CT scan, which is only a few seconds. And so that's why we often choose CT in the first instance for head trauma patients, because we can get the images a lot quicker. The main question that we're asking when we're doing a CT or an MRI is, do we have a reason why this patient needs surgery in order to be stabilized? And the main things that we're looking for there are subdural hematomas or depressed skull fractures, both of which may require surgical intervention to stabilize them. Of course, we may also be looking for neck fractures if we've got head trauma that could be associated cervical trauma as well, that may also need surgical intervention. But in terms of the brain itself, the main question that we're asking is there a subdural hematoma? Is there a depressed skull fracture? So here we have a depressed skull fracture on the right-hand side at the top. That's an occipital fracture that is depressed. This one was actually not a particularly severe degree of displacement, and we did not operate on that dog because we felt that by doing so, the degree of compression was quite mild and that actually we would cause more damage to the parenchyma of the brain by fiddling around trying to fish those bony fragments out. But if that was a more severe displacement of bone, then we may well be looking at surgery to hweak the bit of bone back out of the brain to allow the brain room to expand again as back to its normal shape. And then these are things that can be considered in humans for traumatic brain injury. And I'm not going to dwell on this because we're running over time, but there are some more advanced things that it's interesting to be aware of that they do in people with traumatic brain injury, which maybe will spill over into veterinary medicine for us in the future. But things that they can do, cool things that they can do, they can actually directly monitor the intracranial pressure by putting a catheter into the ventricles of the brain, and that's that actually goes transcranially, so it's called a bolt that goes through the skull into the brain itself, and that gives much earlier indicators of changes in intracranial pressure rather than having to wait to look for a Cushing's reflex. So that's really cool that they can identify changes in pressure much earlier and treat it much earlier than we probably can with our veterinary patients. They may use induced comas to control the intracranial pressure and also use mechanical ventilation to control the intracranial pressure by virtue of controlling the CO2 and strictly maintaining that within normal limits. They may also give seizure prophylaxis in traumatic brain injury for people because people and animals can experience seizures down the line following a traumatic brain injury. And so we don't treat our veterinary patients with seizure prophylaxis at the moment, but maybe that's something that we will consider more in the future if we had more evidence for that. But certainly a proportion of animals can go on to develop seizures months or years after a traumatic brain injury. And therapeutic hypothermia, the idea of that is to rapidly cool the patient so as to slow the metabolic rate, particularly of the brain, and therefore minimise the degree of secondary brain injury by virtue of slowing everything down and slowing down those biochemical chain reactions that we talked about earlier that potentiate the secondary brain injury. And there's still ongoing research into the utility of that, but certainly they just basically inject ice saline to rapidly cool the patient and then take control of them by ventilation. So how do we prognosticate for traumatic brain injury? Well, for me, I think one of the most important things about dealing with these guys is not to prognosticate at the outset, because often you can't tell based on the initial presentation, and they can look absolutely horrendous when they turn up. They can be really non-responsive and have a very low Glasgow coma score, but that can really dramatically improve after extracranial stabilisation and with a little bit of time. So I never, ever, ever would euthanize based on the initial presentation for a traumatic brain injury patient. I'll always try and stabilize them, give it a go, because many, many patients will surprise you by turning around in a very dramatic and pleasing way. So it's then important to monitor their progress by the modified Glasgow Coma score after the initial stabilisation, and as we said before, if that is worsening despite aggressive treatment, then that is concerning, but in many of these patients it will just continue to improve. So that's useful for, that should say 48-hour outcome rather than prognosis. My apologies, that's a typo on my part, but a subtle but important and significant difference. Certainly, if you have a patient who is presenting with bilaterally dilated and non-responsive pupils, so blown mydriatic pupils, and they have very poor mentation, which is not improving or deteriorating despite aggressive treatment, then unfortunately those patients do have a poor prognosis. And also it's known that poorer outcomes are associated with patients who have involvement of the caudal fossa, so the brainstem and the cerebellum tend to have a worse prognosis overall. Patients may have persistent neurologic deficits, but it's difficult or it's impossible to predict up front what those are going to be. So it's always a question of just giving the patient time, and really we need to allow them up to 6 weeks to see how they continue to improve, because that's the sort of time scale over which nerves will heal and improve. And as we said before, these patients can develop seizures down the line. So although it's only a relatively small percentage of cases that that happens in, it's a good idea to warn owners that that may be something that happens that needs further management down the line. So our goals of treatment, overall, we're aiming to optimise the perfusion to the brain, normalise the pressure within the calvarium, the intracranial pressure, and minimise any increase in the metabolic rate of the brain. So thanks for listening. Hopefully that was a useful tour through how to deal with these tricky and challenging patients. This little dog here made a remarkable recovery after jumping out of a car window to chase a cat and got hit by a car coming the other way, presented with very severe traumatic brain injury, but made an absolutely fantastic recovery with no persistent neurologic deficits in the end. So that was a nice little traumatic brain injury success story.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Helen for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.